House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Tuesday, May 12th. First item on the agenda is a public hearing on Senate Bill 87. Open a public hearing.
Senate Bill 87 requires a health care provider to notify the appropriate county medical examiner of a death and provide medical records, tissue samples, and other necessary material if requested to do so. Clarifies that anyone who cooperates with the medical examiner does not waive any claim of privilege or confidentiality. Clarifies that except for a parent, child, spouse, or suspect in a murder investigation, medical records can only be released by court order. Allows siblings to obtain a copy of a medical report, declares an emergency, it's effective upon passage. This has no fiscal or revenue impact.
Okay. Dr. Benson.
Chair Barker and committee members, my name is Dr. Karin Gunson, and I'm the state medical examiner for Oregon. I'm here to discuss Senate Bill 87A, and as you know, the medical examiner does examinations on all natural deaths here in the Oregon. We're charged with investigating those deaths. That includes homicide, suicide, accident, drug overdoses, death in the state, death on the job, and those people who die at home who are not under medical care in the immediate past. Our investigations include scene investigation, autopsies, physical examinations, of course, of the body, family interviews and witness interviews, and medical records. The medical records are extremely important to us in many ways. Most importantly is helping us decide the manner of death. That is it homicide, suicide, accident, undetermined, we can't tell, or natural. If we can't have those records and things like drug overdoses, sometimes it's very difficult for us to make that determination. In the past, well, ORS 146 does require that hospitals, physicians, law enforcement, penal institutions cooperate with us by providing records. Over the years since this bill was first passed, since the statute was first passed, we have more and more paraprofessionals who are entering into patient care. And over the past few years, we've had many of these paraprofessionals tell us that they were not required to give us records because they're not included in that list that's in the statute currently. So we have want to amend our statute to use the term healthcare professionals as far as those people who need to cooperate with us, and that's defined in ORS 192.519, and it includes many of these paraprofessionals who have in the past refused to give us records. The Senate bill, or the Senate did amend this original bill to protect these records requiring a court order before they can be obtained from the medical examiner's offices. Originally, ORS 146 excluded sibling from the list of family members who could receive medical examiner records. So spouse, parent, or child could receive medical records, but not the sibling. And as we know, many times siblings are the only living relatives remaining and would like to have this information. So the Senate did amend this bill to include siblings in the list of family members who may receive these records. And finally, the Senate amended this bill to address public records issues with medical examiner's reports. The Senate exempts the medical examiner's report, autopsy report, and laboratory reports from public disclosure unless an overriding public interest can be shown. This is the way it's always been in the medical examiner's law since it was first passed in the 60s, but it was not clearly defined in the original statute. And in a recent court ruling, the Court of Appeals found that the original statute did not adequately address this issue and that the medical examiner's records would be considered open record or public record. And as you know, our records are full of sensitive material and are considered to be medical records and therefore should only be available to those listed in ORS 146, which includes the family members or those people who are civilly and criminally liable for the death or their representatives. In addition, if we, going forward, have to have our records as public records, we would incur a huge cost because of a number of people who would like to have those records, and many times not just a single record, but multiple records regarding one case. The amendments that I have described for Senate Bill 87 were crafted in cooperation with the representatives of the ACLU of Oregon and the Oregon Defense Attorneys Association. And as stated, if the bill passes, there would be no fiscal impact. The State Medical Examiner's Office requests your favorable consideration on this bill.
Okay, thank you. And Doctor, just briefly, so if a person, a younger person seems to be normal health dies, then you would take a look at those pretty much automatically if they died at home or...
Yes, that's correct. We are charged with looking at anybody who dies suddenly and unexpectedly who's not under the care of a physician. So, say a 30-year-old is just found dead in bed, that would be a medical examiner's case.
And as far as your records being released, if they were public records, then we could all come in some spectacular high-profile murder case and say we want the photographs and so on.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Stigler?
Yeah, I just want to be sure we're all clear. They're still public records. They're just subject under this bill, subject to an exemption.
Representative Barker, Representative Stigler, yes.
Okay.
They're
cool.
Exempted
under
ORS 192.
Correct. Any further questions?
Happy. We love exemptions to public records law around here.
Been quite familiar with.
We hear from the Oregonian about this from time to time. Close the public hearing. Open the work session on Senate Bill 87.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move Senate Bill 87 as amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves Senate Bill 87 as amended to the floor of a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Excuse.
Representative Cameron.
Yes.
Representative Garrett. Representative Krueger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Excuse.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. I'll carry that, I guess. Open a public hearing on... Let's see where it is. Which one?
Two.
Which is the Judge Burr? Which one is Judge Burr?
262?
262.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 262.
Senate Bill 262 allows judges to sit in panels of two to hear and decide cases, allows pro tem judges, allows the chief judge to delegate authority to rule on motions and issue orders in procedural matters to an appellate commissioner, limits de novo review. It says a fiscal impact statement was issued, no revenue impact.
Thank you.
Do we have a fiscal impact?
Mr. Mark Brewer, the chief judge of the Court of Appeals, very much appreciate you're taking the time to visit with us about SB 262 today. I've got some written testimony. I'm certainly not going to read it or summarize it in specific detail, but I'd like to just briefly cover the high points of this proposal and the background for it. This proposal derives from a request from this body that our court and the judicial branch beyond this court submit some efficiency legislation in view of the current budget situation for this biennium. And we've done that, and this bill covers four particular issues that were just summarized by staff. The background for this is that, quite frankly, I think virtually all of these proposals would have been indicated even without the current budget situation. Our court has about 3,500 to 4,000 appeals per year. We have 10 judges and staff to support those judges. Compared to a court with similar workload across the country, we're probably judged and staffed at about a 40 to 50% level compared to those other courts. And so chronically, our court has had more cases per judge than any other intermediate appellate court in the United States. And ironically, specifically with reference to the de novo review provision, we're one of only two states in the country that has universal de novo review in all equity cases. And for those of you who might not be familiar with that concept, equity cases are those in which the right of jury trial historically has not existed in this country. And it dates back to Old English case law, and because of some antiquated history dating back to the medieval times, you couldn't get a jury in certain kinds of cases, and in those cases, the appellate court reviewed the record from the trial court de novo, which means as if we were the trial judge, sitting there actually looking at the witnesses when in fact we're not. It's true that in this state there's been a rich history of having de novo review, and so the proposal in SB 262 would actually preserve the court having discretion to exercise it in proper circumstances, and it would preserve it outright in termination of parental rights cases, which we think are absolutely critical, and we know this body feels the same way. But I have looked at a sample of our case law for the last 10 years, and I can't find a single example in any equity case where our court has reversed a trial court decision based on the insufficiency of the evidence, where we found the facts differently from what the trial court found. And so what we have in these de novo cases is the parties file very long trial briefs saying, first Joe did this, then Bill did that, then Mary did this, and the court's opinions tend to be correspondingly long, covering all the facts just to show that we've reviewed the entire record, when in fact there are probably just a few facts in every appeal that are really critical. And so what we're proposing here is not to throw the baby out with the bathwater and get rid of de novo review altogether, which virtually every other state in the country has done, but to retain discretion, much like the Supreme Court of this state has discretion, to exercise de novo review in critical cases. An example of that, which we would propose to deal with by court rule, would be a situation where a trial court makes findings, but a party says these findings aren't consistent with the court's legal conclusions. In other words, they're not supported by substantial reason. If our court looked at that kind of an argument and we saw that that was the case under SB 262, we would have discretion to look at it as if we were the trial court originally. So if support this change, we will still be one of the three most traditional and conservative courts in the country in preserving and protecting de novo review in limited circumstances in spite of our workload and in spite of the current budget situation. So we feel that in response to the invitation of this body, we are proposing what I think is a moderate solution to lighten up some of our workload and at the same time still deliver critical individual liberty, interest, justice in the cases that come before our court without a loss of that. The other three briefly proposed changes in 262 are, first, we have a motions commissioner, Jim Nass, who is here in the courtroom. I'm going to ask Jim to stand up and introduce him to you. Jim has worked for the Oregon Judicial Department for 25 years. He's been appellate legal counsel. Last year, by Chief Justice order, he was appointed motions commissioner for the Court of Appeals. He has, with the assistance of a new staff attorney, brought our motions docket current in the last year, whereas before that it was weeks, if not sometimes months, behind for lack of adequate staffing. We believed, based on that Chief Justice order, that the court had authority to appoint Mr. Nass as the motions commissioner. It's based on a corresponding practice in the state of Washington, which works the same way, but we actually prefer to have the legislature know about these things and authorize this. So we're asking you to legislatively approve the existing practice that we think is supported by the Chief Justice's inherent authority. Every order of the motions commissioner is reviewable by a three-judge panel, and so the final say would still come from the judges. What we have found since Jim has been doing this work is that we've had very few requests for reconsideration of his orders, and I think every single one, there's only been about 10 in the last year, have been upheld by the court when there has been a request for reconsideration. Chair Barker and members of the committee, the final two proposed changes to current practice in SB 262 involve panel configurations. We are, because of our crushing workload, requesting authority to amend ORS 2.570 to permit the court, in circumstances where it's necessary, to have up to two pro tem judges on a three-judge panel as opposed to one, which is the current rule. We would make this kind of provision implemented only in very limited circumstances. We would use only people like former Chief Justice Wallace Carson, former Chief Judge Mary Dietz, former Supreme Court Justice Bill Riggs, and some of our best veteran trial judges around the state, like Judge Barron from Coos County, who have sat with the court to help us get through some of our caseload. We would only use the highest quality judges to help us in this situation. Our ability to make use of this would be limited because most of our retired Supreme Court and Court of Appeals judges are just about expired on their Plan B service, and so we would have to pay after this year for additional service. So we may not be able to use this without further retirements as much as may be necessary with the budget constraints we face. Finally, we're asking for authority to decide cases as needed in two-judge panels versus three. Where there is a tie, we would have a third judge come in. We would use this only in limited circumstances where cases would be screened to determine the likelihood that oral argument would be waived, because we wouldn't want to argue the cases twice if a third judge had to be brought in to break a tie. We probably would also limit it by court rule to situations in which a party could opt out and insist on a three-judge panel. But we think that many parties want to move their cases along and would be quite comfortable with a two-judge panel. And we think we can actually move about 40 cases a month this way and save one-third of the judge reading and decision time in certain types of cases, probably most likely some of our post-conviction relief cases. And so, in summary, these are the proposals that are covered in SB 262. They are in response to the invitation, which we deeply appreciate from this body, to look closely at efficiency measures in the upcoming biennium. Ironically, they're things that, given our caseload, we no doubt need to do anyway. So we urge your support and approval of SB 262. I thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you, Judge. Any questions from the panel? Representative Barton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Judge, I want you to know I really appreciate what you are trying to do here. The fact that these cuts are necessary sort of breaks my heart, as I know it does you. We really are lucky in the state to be blessed with the Court of Appeals, the appellate courts that we have, and the caliber of judges we have. And again, the Court of Appeals in particular just has a crushing workload. What we really should be doing is adding judges. And it breaks my heart that we can't do that in this budget climate. But I appreciate what you're doing.
And Chair Barker and Representative Barton really appreciate it. And we understand that we're going to have to take cuts along with everybody else, and we want to be team players here. And so this is just part of our approach. So I thank you for your comments.
Appreciate that. And members, the Juvenile Rights Project had some concerns, and as of today, they sent a notice saying that they're neutral on the bill. They had an amendment, but they're going to move the amendment. So, any further questions?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Any further questions? Thank you very much, Judge. Appreciate your time coming on.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing and open the work session on. Oh, I'm sorry, Gail Meyer. You don't have to if you don't want to. Okay. Thank you.
So, dash two is out.
It's out.
Yeah.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 262. Open the work session on Senate Bill 262.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 262 as amended to the House floor with the due pass.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 262 as amended to the floor with the due pass. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith? Vice Chair Siegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Cameron, would you carry that for us, please?
Sure.
Thank you. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 214A.
Senate Bill 214A allows the Attorney General to subpoena records of tobacco product distributors and manufacturers, establishes that failure to comply with subpoena constitutes contempt of court, clarifies that the bill covers all distributors of tobacco products. This is a minimal fiscal impact with no statement issued and no revenue impact.
Okay. Fred Boss and Lisa, I think it's Unlin. Sorry. Go ahead, either one, and please identify yourself for the record.
Yes.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Lisa Udlin, and I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 214. By way of summary, this is a bill relating to ORS 180.400 to 180.455, which we often refer to as complementary legislation. By way of background, in 1999, Oregon, along with a number of other states, entered into the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement, also known as the MSA. Pursuant to the MSA, in order to receive an estimated $160 million per biennium, Oregon agreed to enforce and enact escrow statutes. And our statutes are located at ORS 323-800 to 323-806. Subsequently, in the 2003 session, Oregon enacted the complementary legislation I referenced earlier, and that was enacted to enhance our ability to enforce the escrow statutes. The primary purpose of this bill is to clarify and enhance the ability of the Department of Justice to audit and enforce the distributor reporting requirements in the complementary legislation. Complementary legislation currently requires tobacco product distributors to maintain and provide records to DOJ. This bill simply creates a scheme for enforcement of those reporting requirements. It gives the Department of Justice subpoena power and also gives us a contempt authority if a distributor were to decide not to comply with the law. In addition, this bill clarifies to whom these reporting requirements apply. Currently, complementary legislation could be read to apply only to cigarettes, while the entire complementary applies to cigarettes and roll-your-own tobacco. And this bill simply makes it consistent throughout the legislation. We're here today to ask that you pass this out of committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Mr. Boss?
For the record, Fred Boss, Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. And actually, I'm just here to answer any questions.
Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. Boss? Thank you very much, panel. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 214. Open a work session on Senate Bill 214. Garrett.
Senate Bill 214 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrett moves Senate Bill 214 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Excused.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carried. Okay. Representative Krieger will carry. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 225A.
Senate Bill 225 requires the court to suspend a minor's driver's license if the minor is cited for attempting to purchase alcohol or possessing alcohol and later fails to appear in court, provides that the person's age at the time of the offense, not the time of conviction, governs imposition of a license suspension, no revenue or fiscal impact.
Ronell Schenkel and Dina Ryerson.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ronell Schenkel with the Attorney General's Office, here today on behalf of the Attorney General's Underage Drinking Task Force. You'll have in my testimony, which is ever so brief, and you'll be pleased to hear my remarks will be ever so brief, that the Underage Drinking Task Force had several pieces of legislation. This is one of them. It has significantly changed since its original form in the first chamber. It is, in essence, a gut and stuff of our own bill. What is left in it are two provisions, and I'm not even going to speak to the underlying bill unless you ask me to. The two pieces in there are technical in nature. The first one in Section 1 is actually a fix that came from one of the other pieces of legislation out of this task force, and it has to do with minors in possession and their failure to appear for those actions in court and the remedies available. The second section is a piece that actually Senate Judiciary Committee asked us to include in this bill as well, and it has to do with when a person is charged with a minor in possession crime, but by the time they appear in court, they have turned 21, and whether or not that should still be considered a chargeable offense, and this bill would correct it to make it continue to be an offense since it occurred at the time that they were under the age of 21. I have brought today with me Dina Ryerson, who does have expertise in the area of DUI laws, not specific to minor in possession, but certainly more information than I have available to you since I am not an attorney, and we're happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? This no longer has the suspension or...
All the exciting parts are gone.
Good.
I think we'll fix that. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on the Senate Bill 225 and open a work session. 225 as amended.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnant.
I move Senate Bill 225 as amended to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves Senate Bill 225 to the floor as amended with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, call the roll, please.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye, Senator.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. This one in consent.
Yeah.
We'll probably confuse people with the lead lines, but that's okay. We'll stir them up a bit. That'll be on the consent calendar. I'm going to
stir them up a bit.
Reopen very quickly the work session on Senate Bill 87. Representative Olson.
Aye.
I want an explanation of where he's been before I let him vote.
Can I vote on that, Mr. Chair?
And reopen.
Representative Barton.
Aye.
And then we jump down to Senate Bill 262, open a work session. Representative Olson?
Aye.
Are you here for that one? Okay. Open a work session. Open a hearing on work session on Senate Bill 225A. Representative Olson?
Aye.
You just did that. I'm sorry.
No, we just did that.
You're going to twice.
You changed
it. You must be a Democrat.
214.
Senate Bill, open a hearing on Senate Bill 214. Representative Olson?
225.
214. 214.
Aye.
No further business before the committee.
Leave me alone.
And announcement, we will not be meeting on Friday.
Woohoo!
Hey.
Aren't?
Meeting adjourned.